Studio 360 is supported by Hover, helping you get the best domain names to represent you or your business. If you want to get your ideas on the internet, Hover will help you find the right domain name and include all the tools and support you need to manage it. For 10% off your first purchase, go to hover.com and type in the promo code STUDIOTIME.
Come to me.
How do you hide Scarlett Johansson, who's one of the more recognizable people on the planet?
Scarlett in disguise, driving a white van, asking for directions, and bending the conversation to her agenda.
When was the last time you touched someone?
I'll speak with the director, Jonathan Glazer, about Under the Skin. It's part candid camera, part sci-fi experiment, riveting and gorgeous, and unlike any movie I've ever seen.
If he causes an argument between a husband and a wife, then he's done his job.
And you literally did that with me and my wife.
Well, there you are.
And a very surprising new study about Stradivarius violins. People fetishize them, pay tens of millions of dollars to own one. But are Strads really all they're cracked up to be?
Like it or not, they just have to get over Strads.
Yeah. I'm Kurt Anderson. That and much more is ahead in this hour of Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Right after this.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com. And by Delta Airlines, with personal on-demand entertainment at every seat on all long-haul international flights. Delta, keep climbing.
This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. As literature migrates to iPads and Kindles, what's a pop-up book to do? Well, up its game. A lot. Later this hour, we'll hear how pop-up books are adapting to the 21st century by owning their old-school paperness. And I'm not just talking about the Game of Thrones pop-up book. But before we go all medieval on you, if you call something a Stradivarius, you mean it's the greatest thing of its kind ever. The real things, the violins, violas, and cellos that Antonio Stradivari made, were masterworks. 350 years later, his instruments are played by the superstars. Yitzhak Perlman, Yo-Yo Ma, Joshua Bell, I could go on. Sotheby's estimates that a Stradivarius viola it's auctioning this spring will go for $45 million. And that's in spite of the fact that blind tests have told us again and again that Strads actually aren't necessarily the best instruments. The latest study, out just this week from the National Academy of Sciences, put blinders on 10 top violinists and gave them a mix of Strads and disguised newer violins. The musicians not only couldn't tell the difference between them, but most of the players preferred world-class new violins that cost a hundredth or less what a Strad goes for. To figure out what's going on here, we decided to talk with a world-class violin maker, Samuel Zygmuntowicz. His clients have included the Emerson String Quartet and the late Isaac Stern, among many others. Samuel Zygmuntowicz, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here.
So the fact that these really excellent violinists could not tell the difference between a Stradivarius and a new instrument. As a maker of new instruments, that must have been heartening.
Well, absolutely. And one of the things is that new making has really bloomed in during the time that I've been training and developing my career. You know, this study was interesting because we always felt in a little part of us like, okay, well, maybe the modern violin's louder. Okay, you can play easily on it. Yeah, it speaks well, but there's something about the Strad. And this test, at least in this particular circumstance, apparently there wasn't something about the Strad. I mean, it's not like if you actually look at the results, it's kind of like 50-50.
Right.
What the result tells you is that people like what they like.
Yeah.
Instruments have different characteristics. And it also tells you there was not a definitive family trait of Stradivarius that spoke clearly to every experienced person there.
So if the old ones and the Strads are not necessarily musically superior, why do musicians, if they can afford it, still want to play on old violins?
Right. People speak about Stradivari, but really it's shorthand for saying the makers of that town in that period working in that style. And the instrument really evolved, you know, in the space of really just a couple hundred years. It came to its form that we still use now. And, you know, but if you push past this, the price and the mystique, what you have is you have a superlative example of the gradual incremental evolution of a tool. Skilled makers working with skilled musicians produced something which is incredibly sophisticated and effective as a design.
And the ones, the violins you and your peers make today differ how from those several century old instruments?
My training was as a restorer, and I made my in the early days of my career as a copyist. And it's a great strategy to make something good, especially if you don't really understand the inner workings of something. Then the best strategy is to do exactly what somebody really good did.
So this idea that there is some lost, unrecoverable secrets to the makers of Cremona 300 years ago is just not the case.
I'm not saying that any maker is doing exactly what Strad is, because I can't actually say that because I don't know. However, I can say that we've observed the way those instruments function in depth, both empirically with our ears, and I've been involved in scientific research as well to, you know, to look at the physics of the instrument and the way it vibrates. And so if you know your goal, you can get to your goal from a variety of strategies.
And that scientific study, at least one I know you were involved in, was called Strad 3D, which used lasers and 3D scans, CT scans, to try to figure out why Strads sound that way. What was anything useful learned from that?
Absolutely. One of the things I found strangely moving was that the first thing it did is to say, oh, that's what that F-hole tab is about. That's why the corner looks like that. That's why.
Really? So you actually, it was a reverse engineering investigation.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, with F-holes, for example, an F-hole is a sound hole. It's shaped a little bit like an antique F. So, I mean, when I learned, I knew, well, you need them. If you don't have them, it doesn't work.
Yeah.
But we just copied them. So then once we began to see the vibration patterns, we began to realize that these little tabs and little cuttings of the F-holes are some of the most acoustically active areas of the whole instrument. So this thing that used to be an aesthetic little doodad has all of a sudden, to me, become full of meaning and function.
Interesting. Does it say something about classical music and the people who love and care about classical music that they so fetishize this 300-year-old thing?
My clients, most of them have had the experience of playing, could be Strads, could be Guarneris, Guadagninis. There's almost inevitably a day of reckoning. They have to give back their Strad. And also, it's increasingly impossible. Like that viola that's selling now. I mean, it's kind of a ridiculous price, but there's probably somebody in the world who will pay that price.
The $45 million or more.
I guess you only need one person to do it, right?
And there are only, and that's the thing. There are only whatever 500 or 600 of these in existence, and will only be ever 500 or 600.
Well, I mean, you know, that's the world of money and collectibles. I just can't argue with it. So, but that viola, we can kiss it goodbye as a musical instrument. It was in the hands of one of the wonderful violists in a famous quartet. But it won't be next time. And that's almost universally the condition for musicians. Yeah. So like it or not, they just have to get over Strads.
Yeah.
And fortunately for them, my colleagues and myself, I think the world community of violin makers has really pushed the limits of what we can do. And it's very exciting now.
Samuel Zygmuntowicz, thank you so much.
Oh, great pleasure. Thank you again.
Sam Zygmuntowicz is a violin maker, a luthier based in Brooklyn. You can read more about this new study of Stradivarius violins versus new ones at studio360.org. Last week, I offered a new challenge to you all. Create collective nouns. You know, like a gaggle of geese and a mischief of mice and a pitying of turtle doves. But we want new nouns for new types of people. The list of people we want nouns for, including yoga instructors and venture capitalists, is on our website. We've already received a swarm, a chattering, a blush of great responses, so we called up some of our listeners to hear what they came up with.
My name is Jonathan Kulik. I'm from Santa Monica, California.
My name is Carol Cropley. I live in Olympia.
My name is David Kyler. I live on St. Simon's Island, Georgia.
My name is Barbara Belknap. I live in Minnetonka, Minnesota, and I listen to Studio 360 on KNOW. Okay, here's my list. An illusion of indie filmmakers.
A monocle of hipsters.
A pretense of opera goers.
A Duchamp of conceptual artists.
A racket of DJs.
A vengeance of Trekkies.
A khaki of IT guys.
A vision of venture capitalists.
A quibble of critics.
A contortion of yoga instructors.
And because, as my producer says, we are ultra-nerd-tastic, we asked our listeners to use their collective nouns in a sentence.
A mumble of indie filmmakers is petitioning Landmark Theaters to reduce the quality of its projection and sound.
All the tables at Starbucks were occupied by a suffering of hipsters.
A desperation of Trekkies were headed to the Civic Center in hopes of hearing Mr. Spock present his lecture entitled The Attack on Logic in 21st Century American Politics.
Keep them coming. Post your ideas at studio360.org or on Twitter using the hashtag collective nouns. We'll announce our favorites in a few weeks. Coming up, we've seen plenty of movies about extraterrestrials causing trouble on Earth, but not many are told from the aliens' point of view. And certainly none as intriguing as Scarlett Johansson's character in Under the Skin.
We see the horror of things, the beauty, savagery, kindness. To look at that through her eyes is to re-see it.
I'll talk with the film's director, Jonathan Glazer. That's next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Hover, helping you get the best domain names along with all the tools and support you need to manage them. When you want to get your ideas on the internet, Hover will help you find the right domain name to personalize your blog, business, portfolio, or cat videos. For 10% off your first purchase, go to hover.com and type in the promo code STUDIOTIME.
This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. Jonathan Glazer has made a name for himself directing ambitious, stylish, and occasionally unsettling music videos and commercials. As a feature film director, he's ambitious, stylish, and always unsettling. Here, for instance, is Ben Kingsley in Glazer's Sexy Beast.
Why don't you just put the cigarette out?
What's that, Sancho? You want me to cut your hands off, use it as an ashtray? Yeah, I'll put it out, providing you're prepared to let me stub it out on your eyeball. I'll put it out. Agreeable? No.
After that came Birth with Nicole Kidman, and now his new one, Under the Skin, starring Scarlett Johansson. It's a very cool science fiction movie, gothic but restrained, horrific but sweet, and even funny. Knowing only a bit about it in advance, I figured I'd either love it or hate it. Fortunately, it was the former, which is why Jonathan Glazer is here with me now. Welcome to Studio 360.
Thanks very much. Nice to be here.
So in Under the Skin, Scarlett Johansson plays this alien creature, apparently alien, who drives around looking to seduce and kill men, which sounds vaguely familiar. But the underlying story and how it unfolds and all the rest is completely original. How much of that, how this movie is, came from the novel by Michael Faber, and how much from you and your co-screenwriter?
That's an interesting question, because on the face of it, I'd say very little of it came from the book. You know, I mean, there's nothing that's dramatized in the film that's come from the book, and it's certainly not an illustrative adaptation of the book. Spiritually, I think, yeah. More than, if that makes any sense, yeah. Connected to it, I think, somehow. I'd have to read the book again.
There is not a lot of dialogue in the movie. There's no backstory or real explanation. It's mostly about this sexy, ruthless alien following orders and in the process learning a lot about human beings. Let's listen to a clip from Under the Skin. This is one of the many times when this nameless alien is driving around Edinburgh asking men to get into her van so that she can take them back to her otherworldly lair.
No girlfriend, really?
Oh, I don't have a girlfriend at all.
You're very charming. It's better?
Yeah, sorted.
You have a handsome face.
Aye, yeah. Thanks a lot, cheers.
You think I'm pretty?
Aye, you're gorgeous.
Do you?
Aye, definitely.
You did shoot a lot of these scenes, and that sounded like one of them, guerrilla style.
Mm.
So these were hidden cameras within the van. She drives up and actually talks to a real guy, as in candid camera?
As in candid camera, yeah, exactly that. It was about finding a method to shooting the film which matched the story, which was equivalent to the story. So Scarlett in disguise, driving a white van, speaking with an English accent, driving on the left-hand side of the road, negotiating the traffic, pulling over, one in the window down, asking for directions, bending the conversation to her agenda. And that was all done for real. That was all done by filming people. Members of the public didn't realize they were being filmed, and they were told, obviously, afterwards.
And then you cut, pop out, and say, hi, this is a feature film. This is Scarlett Johansson. Sign this release.
Pretty much, yeah.
And you wanted to do that just for the sheer sort of verisimilitude.
Yeah. It has a quality to it which is very, very, very powerful in this film.
It does.
That you couldn't really replicate.
No, you really see these guys, the gears going in their head of like, whoa, what I'm getting lucky here.
It's quite interesting. You saw blokes doing very different, responding in very different ways. You know, when we were filming it, it wasn't, you know, you think, oh, well, they're all going to just get in the van, you know, and they, of course, that's not the case. Some of them are suspicious, others are, you know.
And to film from within the van, these interactions happening, is it true you had to wait for certain special, tiny, perfect cameras to be invented before you could do that?
Well, we invented them.
Really?
Yeah, there was no... Well, I didn't invent them. I worked with some brilliant people who invented them. But we tested the cameras that were available that are small enough to conceal, but the quality isn't good enough to project.
Uh-huh.
Or that are good enough to project, but they're too big to conceal. So Tom Debenham, one of my collaborators I work with, said, yeah, we need to build it. It's not there. So off he went down to his garden shed and with his soldering iron came out with a camera.
So that must have taken some time. Almost a decade passed since birth to this film. Why so long with such a prolific, creative person as you between features?
Well, I mean, this feature took a long time, you know, and obviously we hope it'll be around for a long time. You know, there's a lot that went into it. What's interesting is the thing that started me, that hooked me in to begin with from the book was really... this idea of looking at the world through this alien lens, in other words, sort of re-seeing things. It's a very exciting thing to think, let's make a film that absolutely stands apart from every other film by virtue of the fact that it needs to be through a lens that is not human. So it has to be different. It has to stand alone in that respect. So that's a great challenge. And then it's how do you do that? So we were writing a more faithful adaptation. And then we began to sort of just jettison that. And then it became... Basically, it ended up where it started, with a story about her and about that very aspect that I was interested in to begin with. But it went on a very long walk.
In an interview for The New Yorker, Scarlett Johansson said that you were, quote, like a kid in the candy store when you were watching an early audience react to the movie with both applause and boos. Why are they booing, do you think?
I don't know. I couldn't tell you why I think they're booing. I don't know.
But did you enjoy it?
Well, I mean, it's... It was. I think it sort of feels right. It feels like with this film, that's what it
because
it
provoked.
Right. Because it's about what you bring to it, in a sense. And I remember that there was a thing I read years ago. John Renoir, the French director, said about, you know, if he causes an argument between a husband and a wife, then he's sort of done his job.
And you literally did that with me and my wife.
Well,
there you go.
But it's a kind of like, you can sort of feel the wall shake a little bit in those moments.
Yeah.
There's something very, very interesting about it.
The film has this haunting, unnerving score that we heard a little bit of by this 26-year-old English musician named Mika Levy. I want to play a little bit of just the music. I can hear that in a Bond film.
I agree with you. There's that she had Bond in her head, definitely. She'd been to see James Bond, I think, quite recently. She's got a lot of Disney references as well. I think she said to me that the film scores that sort of stuck in her head with the Disney films were from when she was a kid. But at the same time, Mika's kind of, you know, she's classically trained since she was 9. So even though she's 27 now or something like that, she's had a lot of experience. And she knows the classical music that a lot of those film scores are based on.
Uh-huh.
So she can refer to the root of things.
Uh-huh. That's interesting.
So she's not really a... she's first time she's ever scored a film.
Well, won't be the last. Although this movie is about, and ostensibly about, this alien invader, it's also throughout a kind of meditation on how strange it is to be a human being on Earth. We watch these scenes of people doing mundane things, shopping, watching television, putting on makeup, through the eyes of this creature, and it starts to look, wow, we're weird, aren't we?
Mm.
Is that an animating idea of yours, that humanity is strange?
Well, aren't we?
Yes.
So it's not my idea. things we take for granted that we pass on the street every day, that we do on the street every day, you know, people drinking coffee, having a cigarette on the phone, in and out of shops, on and off buses. To look at that through her eyes is to re-see it,
yeah,
in a way. We see beauty, savagery, kindness, the sounds, the smells, the colours. She sees and she experiences quite a range of things, and she doesn't take them on, but she begins to have those impulses herself.
Yes. Well, and as you're describing her then, and after I watched the movie, I suddenly thought, the last time Scarlett Johansson moved me in a film was Her, the recent Spike Jonze movie. And these characters are not dissimilar in a certain way, these non-human seductive creatures, yeah?
I haven't seen Her yet.
Well, you must.
I will.
Not only is it good, but they should run as a double feature.
Okay. Use her sound from that film and the pictures from this kind of...
You could do that too. Okay. And somebody no doubt on the internet will. So. I loved your first feature, Sexy Beast, which came out in 2000 and is also about a group of scary, bizarre individuals. I want to play a clip in which Ben Kingsley's character, Don, is trying to convince his criminal pal, played by Ray Winstone, to take a job.
Friday at the Grosvenor, you'll be there.
I won't.
You will, I told Ted you're doing it. Don't you show me up.
No, I won't be there.
You will, you're Mr. Roundtree.
No.
Yes, Roundtree.
No.
Yes, Grosvenor.
No, Don.
Friday.
I won't be there.
You will.
No, Don.
Yes, 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 yes.
That was Gandhi in Sexy Beast, exercising his will. So you've made these three features, that one about these terrifying gangsters, one of them at least terrifying, Birth about death, essentially, and its difficulty, and now this, Under the Skin. You are, in terms of your features certainly, driven exclusively to the dark side so far.
You think so?
Well,
when you played that clip, you had a big smile on your face.
And the dark side makes me smile a lot.
Me too. I mean, I don't know what I'm driven to. I mean, it's hard to, you know, I don't really look back at what I've done and think there's a pattern or I'm interested in those themes, to be honest. That's not mine.
But do you ever think, maybe someday I'll do this, you know, Four Weddings and a Funeral sunny thing?
I doubt that. But I mean, you know, there's maybe with some kind of catch to it, you know. But I'm, you know, Sexy Beast is a funny film.
It is.
I always thought, yeah.
Absolutely.
I'd like to do a comedy. I'd like to make a comedy.
Yeah, well, and that was a comedy-ish.
Yeah, it was.
Some of your music videos, like Radiohead's Karma Police or Uncle's Rabbit in Your Headlights, are very story-driven, whereas other of them, like Jamiroquai's Virtual Insanity, are these pure visual feasts. When you take the gig of making a music video, do you have these visual ideas in mind and think, oh, I've got something that could work there? Or does the music entirely generate the ideas?
Anytime I've ever tried to retrofit an idea I've had into a track that I've been given, it never seems to work. So in other words, you'll have an idea that you don't make for whatever reason, and you stick it in your drawer and you think, I'll make that one day, and you don't. It might morph into something, but it's not, you never make it. So I always think, I respond to the music, and I try and see pictures in it.
For music videos, and certainly for commercials, the budgets you have second per second must be tremendously bigger than your budgets for features.
Mm.
How does that inequity, or whatever it is, affect your work, affect your feelings about the work?
You're absolutely right. When you make if I make a television commercial, it's got a huge amount of money attached to it generally. And for me, the enjoyment is making something well. You know, I have the opportunity to use equipment and a scale that I wouldn't have a chance to use on a film. In the way I make films, but there's something about the rigor of storytelling in say a minute that I've always found really fascinating. It's a very good discipline, and as long as you use it as an opportunity and not think, oh, it's only a TV commercial.
Uh-huh.
I never think it's only anything. I think that's a film I'm making. It happens to be a minute long,
so make it good on its own terms.
Of course.
Jonathan Glazer, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jonathan Glazer co-wrote and directed Under the Skin, which is in theaters now.
Is that all right?
Yeah,
great. What do you need from that, like 60 seconds?
Yeah, exactly. I've got you under my skin. I've got you deep in the heart of me. So deep in my heart, you're really a part of me. One of the reasons I loved having little kids is that they were a great pretext for buying pop-up books, which were so much cooler and more numerous than when I was a kid. And even though my children are now too old, the pop-up book renaissance has continued apace. And the people who make them are now called engineers. Shruti Pinnamaneni has this story, which begins in Westeros.
Every episode of Game of Thrones starts with a map. It sprouts castles, towers, gears push cities out of the ground. It looks medieval, but with a precision that can only be CGI.
This is Pike, Castle Pike.
Matthew Reinhardt has managed to reproduce the magic of the TV show in paper.
Now, this is the wall.
What's that?
This is Astapor.
When you open his Game of Thrones book, it turns into the map. Its pages fan out, and every castle magically pops up in its right place.
It was so hard to figure out every point on the map and making all these different things work. Now I'm going to just close it back up to be a normal book and can go on your shelf.
Reinhardt has made dozens of pop-up books on dinosaurs, Star Wars, Superman, but this Game of Thrones book is a feat of paper engineering.
It's a little bit more expensive than my usual books.
How much is it?
Do I have to?
It's $65, which makes it either a really expensive book or a decently priced piece of art. This is what pop-up artists are doing now, taking entire books and transforming them into these tactile objects you can play with. Once upon a time, in the Middle Ages, scholars put movable parts in textbooks, like rotating paper discs to show the cycles of the moon. It wasn't until the Victorian era before it occurred to bookmakers that these mechanical books would be great for kids. In the 1880s, an artist named Lothar Meggendorfer punched up his books with rivets and copper wire, so when you open a page, you're pitching a whole circus tent with moving animals.
Then in the early 90s, along came a brilliant young designer himself named Robert Sabuda.
Peter Glassman owns Books of Wonder, a great children's bookstore in Manhattan. He says Robert Sabuda's aesthetic felt completely new. A typical page has one giant pop-up, but then you'll see another door and then another. It's all pop-ups within pop-ups.
I remember when I first saw the Christmas alphabet being overwhelmed by the beauty and how innovative it was. And I remember coming to the O is for owl and watching the owl blink his eyes and thinking to myself, man, is this guy good? And knowing this book was going to fly off the shelves, as indeed it did.
The books were a huge hit and pop-ups went mainstream.
They creeped into some of our more mass market formats.
Valerie Garfield is a vice president at Simon & Schuster.
We are one of the larger pop-up publishers for children.
She says in the early 2000s, even basic board books started to have pop-ups. And as the market expanded, the more complex pop-up books became.
It takes a lot more to dazzle a kid now, I think, than it did 20 years ago and certainly 50 years ago, when you think of what they encounter day to day in terms of technology. And then you open a book and say, well, look how cool this paper can be. It really has to be on the top of its game and pretty cool to capture them.
Transformers!
These are my neighbor's kids attacking one of Matthew Reinhardt's other books.
Oh my, look at this. Oh, that's
ooh,
so cool.
Oh, look, you can make them turn from airplanes to Transformers.
What is that one, Bumblebee?
I see a yellow black car.
Cars and trucks pop out of the page and then blossom into robots.
Whoa.
It's a double pop.
I see a bumblebee.
How does that happen?
Everything on the car is part of the body. Then you just flip something and it becomes the body. Not so easy, though.
The book is gorgeously crafted. The paper actually looks like pieces of metal. And the Transformers open with a gratifying snap.
It's a book, but it looks like a toy.
So everyone knows Optimus Prime. You know, he is the leader of the Autobots, and he's this big truck.
The artist, Matthew Reinhardt, is a huge Transformers fan. Really, he made this book for geeks like himself.
You can see it's very detailed, all these little things, like even down to his bumper sticker on the back, Convoy, which is, that's his name in Japan, this Convoy.
There's even a tiny driver in there with a tiny face.
And that is sort of an homage to Peter Cullen, who is the voice of Optimus Prime.
People are always asking Reinhardt what computer program he uses for his pop-ups, but he makes everything by hand.
So these are some early pop-up studies.
They're bars of sturdy white paper flapping and bending on hinges of white tape.
Just to see, okay, so if I have this lever here and it's pushing something else, to give me ideas about how I could make things move.
Sometimes when there's a glitch in the way it moves, he troubleshoots the pop-up using his ears.
You'll listen. Sometimes you'll hear paper, like, rubbing against each other. Like, you can hear it. Well, it's not so bad. There it is. There's a lot of, like, tension inside here. There's stuff that's... So I'll go through and I'll analyze exactly where that sound's coming from, and I'll find it, and then I'll do another version that will have the fix.
Ultimately, Reinhardt will pull the pop-ups apart, scan the different bits, he calls them pop-up roadkill, and send the files to China.
They're all hand-built. They're all hand-assembled.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, there's a machine that will die-cut the pieces of paper, and there's also a machine, you know, that prints it. It's about as big as a bus, and it'll print these huge sheets with all the different pieces on it, but it takes hands to assemble every piece. So, like, you see this T-Rex, there's probably one person that glues on this part of the head thousands of times over, and it's handed off, and there's one person that maybe glues the arms down.
In other words, creativity may be at its peak, but production is still old school. It takes an assembly line of hundreds of people to make one pop-up book. That's why they're expensive. And since the financial crash, they've become a lot less lucrative for both publishers and artists.
And royalty checks just got smaller and smaller, and there were less and less bookstores, like borders closed.
Last year, Reinhardt moved to a smaller studio, let go of his two assistants, and then came this one awful moment.
It wasn't even that much of a bad thing. It was just a terrible advance check that I got on a book that I'd worked very hard for. It was terrible, and I was embarrassed. And then, of course, the drama queen in me, you know, foresees, like, what if you're on the streets? What if you have this? What other job would you do? You have to go back to school. Oh, my God. And then you sort of calm down and realize that it's just about rethinking how you present what you're doing. You can't keep doing the same thing your whole life. You can't keep approaching it the same way. And I've learned that.
His next pop-ups will be much simpler. Those are the kinds of books publishers are commissioning to keep prices down. But Glassman, the bookstore owner, thinks this may backfire. He remembers one artist who was doing these intricate pop-up books in the 80s.
And they were hugely successful. And then the publisher kept sizing them down, simplifying the pop-ups, making the books smaller, less exciting, less visually enchanting. And they stopped selling as well.
In other words, if you want to see a book like Transformers with its crazy paper acrobatics, then you better do it soon. For Studio 360, I'm Shruti Pindamaneni.
Say it's only a paper moon, sailing over a cardboard sea, but it wouldn't be make-believe if you believed in me.
You can see a video of what a painstakingly engineered pop-up book looks like at studio360.org.
But it wouldn't be make-believe if you believed in me.
What's the best way to learn the correct pronunciation?
Oh, I'm sure glad you bring that up.
Still ahead this hour, Hamlet, as you've probably never heard him.
To bear or not to bear, that is the question. Whether it is nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a say of troubles and by opposing, end them.
How to sound Shakespearean, authentically.
That's just ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com. And by Delta Airlines, with personal on-demand entertainment at every seat on all long-haul international flights. Delta, keep climbing.
I'm Kurt Anderson, and you're listening to Studio 360. Your idea of what a Shakespearean actor sounds like probably comes from the likes of Laurence Olivier.
To be or not to be, that is the question.
Rather than, say, Ethan Hawke.
Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune.
Olivier just sounds more Shakespearean. But maybe, in fact, not. Maybe for the last 400 years, the pronunciation of English by English people has changed so much, it turns out we're actually missing the full flavor and the full meanings of Shakespeare's language. Anyhow, that's the theory of David and Ben Crystal, a father and son team of linguists. And Ben is also a successful Shakespearean actor. The Crystals have recreated what they say is original pronunciation, how Shakespeare's plays would have sounded around 1600. David and Ben Crystal, welcome to Studio 360.
Great to be here.
Nice to see you, Kurt.
So when did you and which of you decided to start figuring out the original pronunciation of Shakespeare?
Well, this all started, this is David, and this all started in 2004. When the telephone rings at home, and it's Shakespeare's Globe in London. And the director there, Tim Carroll, wanted to put on a production of Romeo and Juliet in original pronunciation. The Globe, you see, is known for its attempt to reconstruct original practices, you know, original music, original costume, and so on.
Right.
So that's how it started. We did a Romeo and Juliet reconstruction in OP, as we call it, original pronunciation. It was very successful. And since then, the ball has started rolling.
I remember when Dad first started speaking to me about this almost 10 years ago, and he said, you know, I think we're probably about 80% right. And then a few years later, he said, you know what, I think we're actually about 90% right. And he's continuing his academic work on OP and refining that even still. And then on the other side of the fork, as it were, I've gone off and have been exploring it from a practitioner's point of view, and the effects that it has on a company, on the way that they move, on the speed of speech, and indeed the quality of Shakespeare performance that comes out of people when they use this accent.
Just so we can compare apples to apples, Ben, if you can remember it or know it, can you do that, the Hamlet soliloquy?
I'd love
we
to.
Started with?
Hamlet's to be or not to be in original pronunciation. It's the first few lines. To bear or not to bear, that is the question. Whether it is nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a say of troubles and by opposing, end them. To die, to sleep, no more. And by a slab, to say we end the heartache and the thousand natural shocks that flesh is heir to, 'tis a consummation devoutly to be wished.
That's fantastic. In addition to being less portentous than any version of that that I've ever heard, it sounds like most English people in 1600s spoke more like people in the north of England and Ireland do now. So essentially, the accent in the south of England was the one that modernized and became standard?
Well, that's right. The history of English accents is very interesting here. When we did this at the Globe, I spent the interval going around the audience and saying, what do you think? How do you recognize it? And everybody said, we speak like that where I come from. You know, and it didn't matter where they came from, whether they came from the north of England or Ireland or Scotland or even parts of America. They all said, we recognize that accent. And the reason, you see, is that this was the accent that led to many of these other accents. You know, the Irish and Scots and Northern and so on all developed out of it. And, of course, American accents too, because this is the accent that went across on the Mayflower, you see.
And later right. Australian.
And later Australia. Now, the received pronunciation that you heard earlier on with Laurence Olivier, this is a very late accent. It doesn't arrive in Britain, in England, until about the year 1800. It was a class accent, you see, when the new class system was developing, upper class, middle class, lower class, and the upper class people wanted to make sure they didn't sound like lower class people. Then that accent evolved and became the RP that we know today. But in Shakespeare's time, there was nothing remotely like received pronunciation.
In terms of going to see a Shakespeare play, it completely turns everything on its head. So the things that you were picking up there when you heard me do Hamlet's to be or not to be, and you're saying it sounds a bit more colloquial and informal and that kind of thing. You think about the kind of theatrical dynamic that the Globe has, where the lights are on the audience and on the actors mm-hmm. as well, and you can see each other, and there's a two-way dynamic. So they talk to the audience. It's a sort of time to ask your friend for help. You know, what do you think I should do? Do you think I should kill Claudius? Do you think I should believe the ghost? And you know, the audience would reply as well. So suddenly you've got a two-way dynamic. You're much more involved with the action rather than when this more sort of clipped and polite accent came in. The lights were off on the audience. They were observers on someone self-reflecting, and thereby you get this grander sort of, pedestal style of Shakespeare.
That's interesting. So this language helped make the fourth wall non-existent until it was invented sometime in the 19th century.
One of the things you have to appreciate when you are talking about accent is that accent doesn't exist independently of the rest of the body or even the rest of the stage. One of the most noticeable things that I saw when I was sitting in the rehearsal room at Shakespeare's Globe, and next to me was sitting the mistress of movement at the Globe there, Glyn MacDonald.
What a title.
Yes. I was master of original pronunciation, and she was mistress of movement. Wasn't it lovely? Anyway, we're watching the actors on the stage, and this was the first time she'd seen them since they'd learnt the accent. Now, they were already doing Romeo, you see, in the modern accent at the same time as they were doing it in OP. And she looked at me and said, they're moving differently. They're holding themselves differently. Now, the speed difference that we're talking about is quite significant. If I give you an example, when Romeo looks up at the gallery and says, "It," in modern English, "it is my lady, oh, it is my love, oh, that she knew she were," that's about 6 seconds. Now, if you do it in OP, it comes out like this. "It is my lady, oh, it is my love, oh, that she knew she were," that's about 4 seconds. Huh. Now, when you compare the OP Romeo with the modern Romeo, the OP version was 10 minutes shorter because of this speed issue. And that's a lifetime on stage, isn't it, Ben? I mean, 10 minutes shorter is amazing.
I mean, it's everything that you want from, you know, the Romeo and Juliet chorus when he says, "Is now the 2 hours traffic of our stage rather than the, you know, the 3 3/4 hours traffic."
It's so wonderfully counterintuitive, too, since we think, oh, now is the time of speed. And, of course, we're slower.
Well, and, you know, in a much more sort of, I suppose, in a very straightforward effect, you know, "Cry havoc and unleash the dogs of war." Mm-hmm. The line from Julius Caesar, you know, it's a wonderful line that. And, you know, in received pronunciation, it's "cry havoc and unleash the dogs of war." And you sort of think, well, you know, one of the things that you want to do when you're working with actors on Shakespeare is encourage them to bring the colour out in words. Now, how to bring the colour out in the word war? How do you make it sound like war, you know? Well, it's already there for you in original pronunciation. "Cry havoc and unleash the dogs of war," you know. What do you want to... Hello, I'm a dog of war. Chanted to meet you. Or, yes. "I'm a dog of war."
Yeah. The other astounding part of this is that it has apparently allowed you and us to unearth kind of archaeologically puns and jokes that were invisible to us heretofore. Talk about that.
Yeah, this is the thing. One of the questions I bet is in every listener's mind at the moment, unless they're specialists in linguistics, is how do you know? How do you know? How do you reconstruct? And the answer is very simple. You look very carefully at all the rhymes that don't work in modern English that do work in Shakespeare's day, and we can illustrate that in a second. And the next thing you do is you look at all the puns that don't work in modern English that did work in Shakespeare's day. Now, the rhymes are the first thing, before we get on to puns. Mm-hmm. I mean, the sonnets in particular, Ben,
they're supposed to rhyme, right?
They absolutely. Now, 96 of the sonnets don't rhyme perfectly, and you have to ask the question, well, why is that? Was Shakespeare not a very good poet then? Yeah.
And that's most of them, listeners, by the way.
Yes, absolutely. Out of the 154, that's a tremendous number. And the other thing is, you can't get out of it by saying, ah, well, these were I rhymes, you know, rhymes that looked right, even though they didn't sound right, because that wasn't the fashion of speaking in those days. No, the sonnets, and Ben, would you do one for us? Because that will illustrate the point perfectly.
Sure, well, the end rhyme of 116, "If this be error and upon me proved, I never writ, nor no man ever loved."
There we are. Proved and loved. You know, they should rhyme. Now, the question academically is it proved and loved or proved and loved? Now, there, this is where I come in. I go looking at the sources and find that, for example, Ben Jonson, the dramatist, but he also wrote an English grammar, says when he, at the beginning of his grammar, he goes through all the letters of the alphabet, and when he gets to letter O, he says, we pronounce this word short, and he gives examples like glove, prov, love. So he tells us that it's short. So the real version is, Ben?
If this be Aaron upon me proved, I never writ, nor no man e'er loved.
That's fantastic. Ben, you have been leading workshops in the United States and all over the United Kingdom.
And I'm about to again.
Great. How do American actors do in picking up OP versus British? Is there any difference?
Well, I mean, it's fascinating, really, because, you know, Dad sort of, obviously, from an academic point of view, hates that final 10% that he can't fill.
Yeah.
And I've been trying to find a way to turn it to my advantage. So, you know, there's an element in that, you know, my original pronunciation is original pronunciation to 90%. And then that last 10% is, well, I was born near London, so this is my sort of natural spoken accent. And then I grew up in North Wales, and then I went to university in Lancaster, and then I came back down to London, so I got a bit of Cockney as well. And I spent a lot of time travelling around the world, so I got a bit of a transatlantic thing. So my original pronunciation is 90% OP, and then 10% filled with me, you know, the very essence of my sort of accent background. And so it makes speaking Shakespeare, you know, a company who's all speaking in OP, they all sound pretty much the same, but at the same time, they have an ownership over it that, you know, is quite unlike any other. Now, when I was working with the Rena Whites on Hamlet, and I'm about to go to Houston next week to work with a company on Julius Caesar, there are parts of the accent that are more natural to them, you know, like the strong R or whatever, that's very inherent to modern American.
Although not necessarily Texas.
No, well, not necessarily in Texas, but interestingly...
Or Boston, for that matter.
Yeah.
But interestingly, you know, the thing is, you know, people say, oh, well, you know, you think that all plays should be done in the Globe and all, you know, we should be in doublet and hose and all speak in original pronunciation. And, you know, I was working with an actor who was struggling with Oberon, and he had to do the speech, flower of this purple dye, hit with Cupid's archery, sink in apple of his eye. And the rhymes don't work. And I said, well, you know, they do in OP. Flower of this purple dye, hit with Cupid's archery, sink an apple of his eye. Uh-huh. Now, does that mean that, you know, forevermore we should do it in OP? No, it works brilliantly in Southern American. Flower this purple dye, hit with Cupid's archery, sink an apple of his eye. You know, as long as you can speak it in an accent that fits, that's all that's needed, really.
Do you guys ever just joke around and talk to each other in OP? Do this dialogue from Star Wars or something? I don't know.
all the time.
Absolutely right.
And tea time in the crystals.
Yes. But this is a very important thing. When you're working with the actors, as I did at the Globe, and I think you did also in Reno, Ben, that's one of the things I tell them to do when they leave each other at the end of the evening. I tell them, don't say good night to each other. Say good night. You know, get into the habit of using your OP, ordering a pint of beer in the pub or whatever it is. Do it in OP and make it become second nature to you. Very important strategy.
Second nature,
yes.
David and Ben Crystal, thank you so much. This was just a pleasure.
Likewise.
And ours too. Thanks, Kurt.
Ben Crystal is touring the country right now with his own Shakespeare workshop. It'll pop up in San Francisco, Chicago, New York, and Washington, D.C. this month. All the information is at studio360.org. And if you want to learn more about original pronunciation and maybe have a few more laughs, my full conversation with the Crystals is up at our site as well. In Studio 360 over the years, we've done lots and lots of stories dealing with Shakespeare. And since this month is the 450th anniversary of his birth, we've gathered some of those pieces together at studio360.org. Joss Whedon on his Shakespeare, Neil Gaiman on his Shakespeare, Shakespearean sonnets written by your fellow listeners. And this old favorite of mine, a one-man show that mashes together a great tragedy and a great cartoon.
Excellent. No more that Thane of Cawdor shall deceive our bosom interest. Go, pronounce his present death, and with his former title greet...
MacHomer, sir.
MacHomer.
I began performing MacHomer as a cast party joke for our production of Macbeth, and I was playing the lowly murderer number two, and I just had too much time backstage, and I came up with this silly little idea, and this silly little idea has grown tremendously. It's become quite a big show.
I heard the owls scream and the crickets cry, and some AC/DC. Did not you speak?
When?
Now.
As I descended?
Aye.
Hark, who lies in the second chamber?
Malcolm.
Oh, methought I heard a voice cry, sleep no more. Glamis hath murdered sleep, and therefore Cawdor shall sleep no more. MacHomer shall sleep no more, and I love sleeping.
Marge, a guy can do, whereas Bart and Lisa are murder on a baritone like me, so I can get away with a little bit of Bart, you know.
Oh, man. Oh, you know, don't have a cow, man.
That sort of, you know, typical Bart line, and Lisa is just sort of a...
The crass commercialization of this...
It's a bit of a falsetto sound for me. The male voices are much easier.
Oh, who did strike out the light, man?
I can't see anything.
Oh, Fleance has fled.
Oh, man, we lost the little dude.
Well, let us hide Banquo's battered body.
Hey, what's this dead guy doing here?
You can hear our story about MacHomer and all the other stuff we've done about Shakespeare at studio360.org. And that's it for this hour of Studio 360. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope you'll listen again next week. Don't forget, in the meantime, to send us your collective nouns. How should we refer to a room full of critics or a group of indie filmmakers? We've got a list of 10 modern types of people awaiting you and your creativity at studio360.org. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramisferum,
Alana Harper,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Rose Connolly,
Eliza Martin,
Andres O'Hara Plotnick.
And thanks as always to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tiegum.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, recreational marijuana is beginning to go legal in the United States, but will it ever go totally mainstream?
Being a lean-in mom, you're always looking for the best product. Can we replace that end-of-day glass of wine with the end-of-day glass of pot?
That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.